I'll take Beer Doctor for 1,000, Rachel.
Here we go. This ale with the Luder name was created in 1995 by Dr. Keith Villa, who suggested serving it with an orange slice.
What is Blue Moon?
Ding, ding, ding. That's correct. And you've won an interview with Keith Villa.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to this bonus episode of False Bottom Girls, exclusively for our Patreon subscribers. With us today, we have Keith Villa of Seria Brewing. And you're located in Arvada, correct? Just outside of Denver?
Right. Arvada is almost right in between Denver and Boulder.
Right. I know I've driven through there a couple of times, getting from Denver to Boulder. So that sounds familiar. but thank you so much for joining us today. And if you would like to just, you know, give our listeners an introduction to yourself and to Seria.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jen. And thank you, Rachel, for having me on today. Yeah, it's my pleasure to talk to you and your listeners. So quick intro. Gosh, I've been in the brewing business quite a while. Let's see. I was a home brewer starting in about 1982 and professional brewer starting in 1986. And so it's been a long time. I have a PhD in brewing from the University of Brussels. So not a lot of people have an actual PhD in brewing.
Yeah.
There are people in the industry who have PhDs, but a lot are in the biological sciences, chemistry or biology, microbiology, but very few have an actual brewing doctorate. So it's been fun. I learned quite a few techniques and I guess just different ways of formulating beers and troubleshooting beer brewing while I lived in Belgium for 4 years. So that's just a real brief background of, I guess, my brewing. I've been a judge since 1993, BJCP judge, and I've judged the Great American Beer Festival since then, World Beer Cup. And I've been to, as far as Japan, to judge competitions out there. And then as far as work, my whole life has been dedicated to brewing. So my first job was working at Coors Brewing Company in the research and development area. And then I went on to create Blue Moon Brewing Company for them and started with nothing from ground zero and grew it to become the biggest craft beer brand or pseudo craft, whatever you want to call it, in the US. I retired after 32 years and then started my own company with my wife. She's a civil engineer by training and education and career. So she retired. She became the CEO. I became the president and brewmaster of our new company, Seria Brewing, which is dedicated to making non-alcoholic beers only. We don't make alcoholic beers there. And some of those non-alcoholic beers are shipped to the cannabis market to be infused with cannabis and packaged. They're currently for sale with cannabis in the Colorado market and the California market. What else? And then Seria, non-infused, non-alcoholic beer, which actually is 0.0%. So it can be called alcohol-free beer. Mm-hmm. It's in 22 states, as well as Puerto Rico and where else? We're testing in Europe and in Canada.
Wow.
So it's been a fun time being in the brewing world. I still judge home brewing competitions as well as professional competitions. For me, brewing is just part of my life. It's always been.
Yeah.
Probably always will be. And in fact, my pilot brewery is just to my left that way there. A two-barrel pilot system, and in that system, I can brew and develop almost any type of beverage, whether it's beer, kombucha, hard seltzer, you name it, non-alcoholic beer, I can do anything at the two barrel scale. So that's a real brief overview.
That's nice. Awesome. Yeah, thank you. You know, I have to tell you, I think it was JBF in 2020 was my first year being invited to judge. And it may have been there, or it may have been at maybe like National Homebrew Con, but you and I sat at a lunch table next to each other. And I remember like it was still being my first year. So I was kind of trying to like look at people and figure out who they were, because you know, like at JBF, you were around all of these icons in the industry. And I kept looking at your name and thinking, I know this name. This guy is so familiar to me. And then we just had like lunch conversation with the table. And later on, I Googled you and was like, oh my God, that was the creator of Blue Moon. That's how I know his name. I read about this guy. And I think I actually texted Rachel too and was like, I was just sitting next to the creator of Blue Moon and didn't realize it.
Gosh, well, hopefully I was nice.
Yes, very nice. Yes.
Competitions,
you probably wouldn't be here today if you weren't.
Right.
It is nice going to the competitions and interacting with, especially with judges who are new, because it's intimidating to be, judging, and then not just judging, but at that huge national scale with professionally produced beers. And on top of that, sometimes you're sitting next to people like, well, for me, I'm a little more humble, I guess. I still love judging next to some of the people I respect, like Dan Carey from Chris. Mm-hmm. Who else? There's just tons of people. The guy who started Racer 5 in California, I forgot his name.
Bear Republic.
He and his dad Richard and his dad Richard from time to time, Garrett Oliver from
Brooklyn.
Just some of these people who've been around for a long time, and it's always fun to judge with them, and it's from my perspective it's fun, part of that group that's been around for so long. And some of them have changed the course of brewing history. So it's really a kind of a neat experience to get together. And then also, as I was saying earlier, it's nice to be with the newer judges and help them to not be so intimidated and really get in and judge fairly, and also interact and, you know, meet people, network, and just help the organization.
Right, yeah. Exactly. I did get to judge with Pete Schlossberg this year, and ended up eating lunch with him of Pete's Wicked Ales. And you sit down and you see all of these names around you, and it can be really intimidating. And everyone is just so welcoming and so respectful and so nice that it's just a really great. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind switching gears behind Syria and doing non-alcoholic beers, and then also doing the THC and CBD infused beers.
Yeah, especially like, did one come before the other, or are they both like the goal? That's what I was curious about. Like, did you start out with non-alcoholic and then decide it? Sorry, you could tell us.
Well, first the inspiration. The inspiration was after 32 years at Coors / Blue Moon / Molson Coors, you name it. 32 years was a long time at any job. That's a long time. And so it over there, after that amount of years, I came to the conclusion that I had done almost everything that I wanted to do. I created my own brand, grew it to become really huge. I reformulated a bunch of the beers, like Coors Banquet beer, the Killian's Red beer, came up with a lot of new products, and traveled around the world, launched Blue Moon in 25 countries. And after 32 years, I decided, well, I'm going to retire. And at Coors, they had this program, which they stopped in 2005. But the program was a retirement program where after you worked so long, if your years of service plus your age equaled 85 or more, you could walk out. It was called the rule of 85. You could walk out the door with a pension and with your insurance and all that other stuff. And I thought, this is perfect, because I started when I was young, and now I can have another career. And so I had been thinking about cannabis for a long time, because in Colorado, it became legal in 2012. And Colorado was the second state in the U.S. to legalize recreational marijuana. And so I had wanted to get into that area, and I wanted to get into beverages, because I thought at that time that a cannabis beverage would be a great alternative to an alcoholic beverage. And so I retired, and then my wife and I got together and formed Seria Brewing Company. We incorporated in December of 2017. And then I got busy working on different recipes and found out right away that you can't legally produce a product that contains both alcohol and cannabis. That's illegal. Okay. Level and illegal at the state level. And so I had to get to work quickly to remember how to make good tasting non-alcoholic beers, which they had talked a lot of that in Belgium when I was there at getting my PhD. And of course, Belgium's gone through world wars, and people have had to scrimp and save and try to make beer out of you name the adjunct, and they've tried, simply because at one point or another, coffee wasn't available. So they would make coffee out of chicory and all kinds of other things. And they made beer out of lots of different things too. And so they're very creative, and they learned how to make really good tasting non-alcoholic beers over the years. So I had to reach back in my memory banks and remember how they did everything. And then try to create some really good tasting non-alcoholic beers as the base for Seria. And then after that, we had to come up with a name for our company, because we didn't really have a name. It's funny, because you two know that in the States, there are around 9,000 breweries, most of them small, and most of them really innovative and creative. And so all the cool creative names have been taken. So for a brewery, I mean, there's so many cool names out there. The nice fun ones have already been used. And so my wife and I looked at my doctoral dissertation, and the school that I went to, it's University of Brussels, but the brewing school is located on a food industries campus called the Seria campus. And it's named Seria for a couple of reasons. One, it's an acronym that stands for the Center for Teaching and Research in Food Industries in French, but it's an acronym for that. But the name Seria also derives from the Roman goddess of agriculture, Ceres. She's the Roman goddess. And in fact, a big statue of her is right at the entryway to the campus. If ever you go to Brussels, to the Seria campus, it's this huge golden statue of Ceres. And so my wife and I thought, why don't we call our new company Seria, after the campus and after the Roman goddess of agriculture? And so we looked, and nobody had trademarked it. So we said, let's do it. So that's how we got the name for the brand. And so, yeah, we had the non-alcoholic beers. I quickly formulated those. We had the brand name, and and then the last thing was really to get the cannabis into the beverage in a water-soluble format. And so I got to work with that, on that with some other folks. And then we launched our cannabis beer in 2018. And we have a Grainwave Belgian White. It's called Belgian White, but the name is Grainwave. And then we did an IPA, and the name there is called Indie Wave. And we ended up putting 5 milligrams of THC in the Belgian White and 10 milligrams of THC plus 10 of CBD in the IPA, and launched those. They did really well here in Colorado. So we decided to go to California and we launched over there. And we've been in the California market about, I don't know, 4 months or so. So it's still relatively new. So over there. Meanwhile, people had told us they wanted our beers in a non-infused format because these were people like first responders, truck drivers, military, and they get tested for drugs all the time. So they asked because they said they taste great, but we get tested. And so we said, well, we're more than happy to do that because we already make the base product. Right. So it's easy to just send it down another pathway to get packaged. So we rolled out our non-infused NAs in 2020. And yeah, right during the pandemic, which is not the best time to launch. product, but we stuck with it, and yeah. So now we're in two states with cannabis and 22 states with non-cannabis products, and then we just went through a big label refresh exercise with our marketing company. So we'll be having a whole new label and look for Seria soon, and then we also petitioned the federal government, the TTB. To let us put alcohol-free on our labels instead of non-alcoholic beer. Because since we launched, we've always been at 0.0%.
Yeah.
Almost all the NAs in the market are less than 0.5. So they have a trace of alcohol.
Yeah, right. That's an important difference.
Right. And the TTB, they allow you to call it NA, non-alcoholic, if it's less than 0.5, but above 0.0. And if it's truly 0.0 with no measurable alcohol, they allow you to call it AF or alcohol free.
Okay.
So it's a big difference, mainly in terms of flavor, because if you taste some alcohol free beers out there, a lot of them are very watery. Mm-hmm. Because when you get to 0.0, it's hard to make a beer taste like beer, smell like beer with zero alcohol. But we have ours at zero and get great reviews. So it's going to be on our next iteration of our label is that there's 0.0 alcohol free. And there's surprisingly, there are a lot of people who search out alcohol free products, mm-hmm. whether they're on a medication or pregnant women or people for religious reasons. May choose to have absolutely no alcohol, not even a trace. Mm-hmm. And then there's just a lot of people who are sober curious that want to give up every trace of alcohol too.
Right.
So it's fun meeting all kinds of new customers and also delivering beers that they like.
Right. Thank you for that. That definitely when Rachel and I were prepping for this, we were talking about the like kind of which came first in that. So that makes perfect sense that you can't have alcohol and THC in the same mix. One of the things, and not, I don't want, if we get into any kind of like proprietary information, you can tell us that, that's fine. But you talked about the challenges of getting the THC and CBD into the beer in a water soluble form. Mm-hmm. So what were some of those challenges? And then to the extent, you know, you would like to talk about those methods that you use to make that water soluble, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So hops and cannabis are like cousins in the family tree of Cannabaceae, and hops and cannabis, the main components that you find in the hop cones or the cannabis buds are very oily. So it's really tough because when you brew with hops, all of us have brewed, whether it's homebrew or a big professional brew, when you brew with hops, our utilization is only about 30%, give or take, which means we lose about 70% of the material we put into the kettle. Mm. And that's because hops are hydrophobic. A lot will stick to the sides of the kettle or just not go into solution and you end up losing it. So same with cannabis. Cannabis is oily, so you have to figure out how to make it water soluble. And so from a real general perspective, nothing about the general perspective is real proprietary, but really to make a water soluble, there's just four steps. It's pretty easy. The first step is to extract the cannabinoids or the cannabis buds. And extraction is almost the same as extracting hop extract. You can use CO2. There's a lot of companies that have sprung up in the last 2 years that provide small scale extraction for the cannabis world. And you could buy a nice CO2 extractor, or you could even build your own, but they're not very expensive. And then you end up getting a oily extract. And so once you have that extract, that's step one, extract your cannabis, or you can do it with hops too. Step two is to encapsulate, or actually no, step two is to activate. You have to activate the cannabinoids, because a lot of people don't realize that cannabis buds have all the stuff in them, the magic, the THC, the CBD and everything. But those things that are called cannabinoids, they exist in an acid form. So it's, instead of THC, it's called THCA for THC acid. And CBD exists as the acid, and it's called CBDA. And so those are not active on the body or physiologically active. So if you were to eat cannabis buds, you're not going to get high, but you will benefit from some of the things that are in there, because they're healthy. So going back to the water process to make them water soluble, first is to extract them. So you've got oil. Next is to activate them. And all you have to do is heat the extract. You just throw it in the oven for like 130 degrees C for 30 minutes. And the heat will break off that acid unit, and then they're fully active, and it'll make you high, or the CBD will make you sleepy, whatever. So again, first is to extract, second is to activate, third step is to encapsulate. So with that, you just take any vegetable oil, whether it's corn oil, peanut oil, coconut oil, any vegetable oil you can use, you just mix it with the extract, and you just heat it, mix it together until it's nice and homogeneous. And it's pretty easy. You just mix it in a beaker and heat it. And after maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, it's nice, and it looks milky, and it's all homogenized. And what you're doing there is you're just making it very homogeneous, spread out, so that the cannabinoids are encapsulated with oil, and everything is in a nice homogeneous solution. So you don't have like high amounts of cannabinoids here, over there. So it's all equal. Then the last step is you emulsify it. And there's different things you can put into emulsify, but basically emulsifiers are things that you can add to make an oily solution stay in water. I guess the best way to think about it is, if ever you go to a restaurant or even in your own kitchen, if you make a salad dressing and you take vinegar, you put them together and you shake it. But if you leave it, you see eventually they separate. You'll see the vinegar separate and the oil separate, and you'll have two layers. But if you use something like sugar or egg whites, chefs use all kinds of different things, vegetable gums, you add that in and shake it up, then the stuff will stay together for a long time in one solution. And that special ingredient you add is called an emulsifier. And so it keeps the two together in suspension. And there's a lot of really cheap, good emulsifiers out there. So step four is to put an emulsifier into your solution. And then after that, you mix it for 10 minutes and you're done. Then you have a solution of cannabis or even hops that you can put into your coffee, your tea, your water, just swish it and it goes in. And all of a sudden you've got cannabis water, cannabis beer, cannabis coffee.
Okay.
And so it's not difficult to do that, but the tough part is to figure out the real specifics it's not just tough, but it's also proprietary, because you can formulate your cannabis extract that's water soluble, that doesn't stick to the can walls, because all of us know that in a can, if you have a can, whether it's cans for Coke, Pepsi, Budweiser, Coors, whatever, they're aluminum cans, two-piece, and the interior has a sprayed-on liner that's organic, and that attracts cannabinoids. So if you put this beverage in, almost all the cannabinoids will stick to that liner, and you'll have zero active cannabinoids in your beverage. So that's why you've got to figure out how to put the water-soluble extract together so it keeps everything from sticking to that liner.
Okay.
And then also you have to make sure that the emulsion doesn't affect the stability of the head of the beer, the clarity that you're going for, a lot of different quality aspects you have to study to make sure they're all unaffected by the water-soluble emulsion.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of the liner and things like that. There's a lot of considerations there for making sure that the product that you put in the package continues to be the product that comes out of the package.
Yes. So
that's really interesting.
Yeah. It takes a lot of work. But just the big picture view is that you can make the things water soluble in four easy steps: extraction, activation, encapsulation, and emulsion. And literally within, if you did them all in one day, I would say takes about 2 hours for extraction, maybe 3 hours, activation, 30 minutes, encapsulation, maybe 20 minutes, and then emulsifying, 10 minutes. So in a half day, you can have extract ready to go.
Right.
And you get, again, like I said, you could use hops. And in fact, now there are some hop companies that are making terpenes from hops water soluble. Mm-hmm. Almost all of us have dry hopped IPAs. And when you dry hop, you lose a bunch of beer. That's one thing brewers hate is IPAs typically, when they're dry hopped traditionally, you'll have 15 to 20% losses. Just the beer is gone because of all the hop pellets, that hop material attracts liquid, the beer, and then you end up losing lots and lots of beer. So it's no secret that a lot of the hop companies are trying to address that. And by doing so, they're making the terpenes water soluble so that you can put those in and not lose anything. And I've tested some first iterations, and they work really, really well, because you just put a little bit in and it just makes the beer smell and taste like it's been dry hopped.
Right.
So I think in the future, brewers are going to have a few different ways to make dry hopped beers taste really, really good and interesting. And in the future, you may also be able to add dry hop notes from cannabis, because the cannabis varieties are very similar to hop varieties. They've got all these nice aromas. The main, I guess, problem though, is that cannabis has a lot of MBT, that is the common skunks. And so with that MBT being the primary aroma, almost all cannabis varieties have dank, skunky aroma. But in the future, people should be able to get past that. One way that you might be able to do it, which I've talked about and written about, is by using copper. My daughter, she's a mechanical engineer by formal education, but she works for us now, and she and I did a study in 2020 where we found that adding a little bit of copper binds up the skunky smell in beer and cleans it up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You can put your beer in bright sunlight. And if you do it, just open a can, stick it out there, it'll turn skunky. If you add a tiny bit of copper and put it out there, it's protected. And so with those findings that we published, people should be able to wash cannabis extract with copper and deactivate any MBT and then use cannabis strains or the varieties to dry hop beers, because you get really nice aromas from some of these varieties. Like there's one that smells like blueberries, one that smells like pineapples, some that are very citrusy. So lots and lots of new potential flavors that you get from dry hopping with cannabis once right. You clean up the skunkiness.
Right. That's so on a somewhat related note, I was recently listening to a podcast talking about like the history of utensils, and they were talking about the different materials that spoons have been made out of. And one of them was copper, and the host had tasted different foods with the different materials. And they said, you know, the copper spoon was awful. Everything tasted terrible. But in my mind, I thought, I wonder if you could use something like a copper spoon with something that has a lot of high sulfur in it to kind of neutralize that, if, you know, that could be a solution. If you had, you know, something like a really skunky beer, could you start with a copper spoon and maybe it wouldn't be as skunky?
So that's here, customer, let me fix that for you. Yeah. Right. Just go around to everyone on the patio. Anybody need a fix?
Yeah.
It's your skunkiness. I love right. it. I love it.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And just, this is more of just kind of a personal inquiry, but when there are, I'm very sensory focused. So what are some of the companies or places out there who are doing a lot of that cannabis sensory?
Mm. Oh gosh. Most of them are private companies. Mm. So, cause obviously they do the research and they want to sell products and make money. Whereas when my daughter and I published our work, we did it for the benefit of brewers everywhere rather than keep it. I guess we could have patented it and kept it secret and everything, but we decided to release it and open up another avenue of research for brewers and cannabis people. But to answer your question, there's probably a handful of companies that are going to be using that type of technology. And mainly extract companies, but I also think big cannabis corporations will also probably do that when they get into beverages and other forms of cannabis, because a lot of people don't really like the smell of that skunky MBT light struck taste. Mm-hmm. Very, very polarizing, meaning you either like it or you hate it.
Right.
The funny part about that compound is there are a small amount of people who just love it. They can't get enough of that skunkiness. And then the majority of people say, yuck, that smells like a dead skunk. I don't want to be near it.
Yeah. Right. I like the skunkiness smell. I know it's weird.
I do too. Yeah. I do in certain settings, but yes, I grew up in the Ozarks. I'm used to smelling skunks all the time. And so that's not, for me, that's not a terrible smell.
Well, it just doesn't remind me of skunk. Like I just associate it with weed and hops basically, right. You know? So I think that's why I'm like not grossed out by it, I guess.
Well, yeah. Yes. And also for some people, it's actually for a lot of people, it's the sensory cue that triggers the smell of import beer. So like Heineken, Corona, all those brands that are sold in green or clear glass bottles.
Right.
Exactly.
They're very skunky. And I remember talking to a colleague from Heineken once, and they did a test where they tested Heineken in cans that was not skunked at all. And people smelled it and tasted it and said, you know, there's something wrong with this beer.
Yeah.
It doesn't taste like Heineken. And so I think after that, what they did is they implemented some way of skunking the beer at the brewery and then packaging it so that it has that import cue, which so many people, especially here in the States, they smell it and they say, that's the imported beer.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Yes, and I've done a similar kind of a side-by-side with Corona Extra, just in the regular clear bottle, and then Corona Familiar or Extra Familiar that comes in the brown bottles. And I, you know, I've been surprised a couple of times in blind tastings that Corona Familiar in a just in the brown package without the skunkiness is really a pretty solid beer. You know, I've had it and said, like, what is this? And it turns out that it's Corona Extra just in that brown bottle. But yeah, so I know one of the other questions we had for you, and I think you've kind of answered this already, but where and how is the cannabis added in the brewing process?
So we add it at the end, mainly because you can brew with cannabis, but it's really expensive. In my book, I wrote a book called Brewing with Cannabis, which is geared mainly towards, I would say, craft brewers who want to get into it, because I talk about how to market it, how to sell it, all the legalities, and how to put it into beer. Yeah, you don't want to brew with it because simply the cost. The buds, gosh, here in Colorado, I'm not sure if it's legal where you folks are, but oh, no, okay. Nope. I see the sad faces.
Not yet. I'm sure it'll be legal everywhere.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, eventually. But here, an ounce of really premium buds can be $200 to $300. And so if you make a 5-gallon batch with an ounce of buds to get all the THC you need, you know, you're talking maybe $200. Let's say you get a cheaper batch. So $200 for just the buds, and realize that you lose roughly 70%. So that's a lot of money that you goes right down the drain if you put it on the hot side. But if you extract it the way I talked about earlier with those four steps, extract, activate, encapsulate, and then emulsify, and then put it in at the end, you have very minimal losses. Put it in the beverage, and you can calculate down to how many milligrams per 12 ounces you want in each bottle. And so it's very easy to do, very scientific. It's repeatable. So, and it's something that a home brewer can do as well as a professional brewer. Although most professional brewers still aren't getting into it, primarily for two reasons. The primary reason is they could lose their brewer's license because you work with anything federally illegal in a brewery. And the second thing is it really is difficult to make a good tasting non-alcoholic beer and then to get the cannabis in it. That's tough. So losing your license plus just the difficulty, it kind of tells why so many people are not doing it just yet.
Mm-hmm. Right. And do you predict seeing more craft brewers moving in to doing something like non-alcoholic cannabis beers, or do you foresee more people from outside the craft brewing world kind of creating that from the standpoint of wanting to create a non-alcoholic cannabis infused beer?
Both. I think both craft brewers as well as people from outside the industry, brewing industry, are getting into it. We're already seeing a lot of craft brewers getting in, but as I said earlier, there's approximately 9,000 craft breweries, most of them craft breweries, here in the States. The issue is that many of them don't have formal brewing education. They're home brewers who made a successful batch, maybe won some awards, or they just made a decent solid beer and decided to become professional. And so since a lot don't have formal brewing education, they don't realize some of the things they do that can actually hurt or kill people. So with non-alcoholic beer, the reason beer has been with our Western civilization for so long is mainly, in my opinion, and I think historians also, is because alcohol kills any kind of pathogenic microorganisms. Mm-hmm. Years ago, the Egyptians, Sumerians, the Aztecs, they all had an alcoholic drink. And these drinks weren't high in alcohol. They were only maybe 2 or 3, maybe 4% alcohol. But they did that to make water safe to drink. Now, when you remove alcohol, beer becomes capable of supporting the growth of pathogens. And by pathogens, you know, I'll be clear, things like E. coli, botulism, these type of things can grow and make people sick or actually kill them. And so that is the primary reason that we have to be very careful in this area, because a lot of craft brewers have put products into the marketplace right now that that are not pasteurized. And what they typically do is on the label, somewhere on the back of the can, it'll say, please keep cold or keep refrigerated. And that's
right. Oh my God. I'm rolling my eyes so hard right now. I just want you to know, because when I learned how to brew, here's me on my old person stick. You just, you know, that wasn't a thing we had to worry about because you didn't do stuff like that. But yeah, sorry, not to interject.
Well, yeah. So when people put that on the label that says keep cold, keep refrigerated, the main reason for that is to minimize the growth of things in that beer because it's not pasteurized. So pathogens are the primary issue. Second issue, which is also critical, is that brewer's yeast or even diastaticus can get in and start re-fermenting and then turn what was a non-alcoholic product into an alcoholic product.
Yeah, even more.
We've analyzed some around here in the Denver area and found some NA beers to be as high as 2.5% ABV.
Wow.
So if you're really trying to avoid alcohol, it's, you know, the craft brewers, typically, I don't want to badmouth craft brewers, but it's so competitive that a lot of them are I'm not going to say desperate. They have to pay the bills at the end of the month. And so they're searching for anything that can get sales up and get money in the door. Mm-hmm. So their lead sellers are very slow in sales. And NA beer is one of those things that's taken off like crazy. Hard seltzers was the last thing. Hard kind of softened up, but you saw most craft brewers come out with a hard seltzer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's alcoholic. It'll make money for them, but now it's softened up, so they're looking for something else. Now some are starting to come out with NA beers because number one, you don't pay the federal excise tax, so it's you make more money. The second thing is it's easy. Well, it's easy to make an arrested fermentation beer. You take your regular beer and you just stop it before it makes more than 0.5% alcohol. And then you try to remove all the yeast so it doesn't keep fermenting, mm-hmm. and get it out the door. But as I said, a lot of brewers don't go through the added expense of pasteurizing to totally stabilize that beer.
Right.
So it can potentially be harmful. So that's why I advise people, if you go shopping for NA beers, craft beers, the big brewers, they are smart. They've done this so long that they will not put themselves up to any kind of legal situation. So all the beer that's non-alcoholic produced by big brewers is pasteurized. Mm-hmm. Small brewers, not a lot of them pasteurize. And so if you go shopping for craft NA beer, avoid any cans that say keep cold or keep refrigerated. Avoid any cans that are bulging, because if they're bulging, that means something's growing in it. And you brewer's yeast, diastaticus, or some kind of weird pathogen that could make you sick or worse, because I always give the story of here in Colorado, up in Boulder, there was a juice company called Odwalla Juice, and they always prided themselves on their fruit juices that were not pasteurized, because they said, oh, pasteurization ruins the vitamins and it ruins the natural flavor of the juice. And obviously that's false. It doesn't do that. And so this company was selling raw fruit juices, And they had batches every now and then that were contaminated. And one batch got out that was, I believe it had E. coli in it. And it ended it made like 60 people sick. And there was one girl who ended up dying. I think she was 6 years old or something like that. Anyway, they pasteurized. And it's like, okay, does it take killing people for you to do the right thing? And that's why with craft brewers, whenever I see a new one in the market that's not NA, if I know the people, I give them a call or I text them and I say, are you pasteurizing? Because do you realize that dangerous things can grow in non-alcoholic beer? And of course, most of them say, oh, I didn't realize that. And it's like, you're a brewer. You just put stuff out in the marketplace.
Right. Yeah. So
that's why it's, from my perspective, going back to your original question, do I see people getting into it? Yes. Craft brewers, as well as non-brewers, are going to be getting into it, but they have to do it in a safe manner. And let's see, I spoke a little bit with Bob Pease from Brewers Association and about the need for that, for pasteurizing and making sure that anything made by craft brewers is safe for human consumption. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, you can't say that NA craft is safe for human consumption. You can't absolutely say that.
Yeah. So,
but there are some brands that are pasteurized, and ours is one of them. We pasteurize every can, and you have to make mm-hmm. do it the right way, because pasteurization is performed using pasteurizers, tunnel pasteurizers, and you have to meet certain criteria. It's called PUs, pasteurization units, and that's what you need to kill everything in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
regular alcoholic beer typically has to be pasteurized anywhere from about 12 PUs up to 25 PUs. That's more than enough to stabilize alcoholic beer, whether it's craft or big brew, whatever. Non-alcoholic beer requires more, anywhere from 50 to 100 PUs. And of course, a pasteurizer is expensive. It adds cost. And for us, we make sure to do that. That's why our products are expensive out there. Mm-hmm. And then there are some craft beers that are not pasteurized that have that same high price point, and they're making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's potentially dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. So it's frustrating.
Right. Wow.
I do have a question, switch subject just a little bit, but so I used to live in Colorado when weed is legal. So I remember, and it corrects me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure to open a dispensary, you also had to like grow at least like one of the strains that you sold.
It used to be vertically integrated. So some states right now are still that way, where you have to grow your own product and then you can sell it and everything else. But here in Colorado, the laws have changed. So
got it.
It doesn't have to be vertically integrated.
So you don't have to grow your own product.
No.
If it was the old law, would you have had to grow your own product?
Yes.
Got it.
Because the reason for that was because it was easier for the regulatory agencies to trace every single milligram of THC from in the grow house all the way to the finished goods. But now you can trace it through, it's called the metric system, which from the grower all the way to the finished goods, things are put into the metric system so you can track everything. And the regulatory agencies here in Colorado, our Colorado regulatory agency is called the MED. It stands for the Marijuana Enforcement Division. And they check everything out. And you have to, make sure you account for where all your milligrams came from. And then on the label, if you say it contains 5 milligrams, it has to be plus or minus, I think it's like 12% here. It used to be 15. No, that's, I think it is 15. It's 12% in California. So you're given some leeway. But yeah, you still have to keep track of everything. Because for us, like we put in THC and CBD. We don't put like varieties. People will ask us, oh,
yeah.
Variety does it have? Is it Girl Scout cookies? Is it Purple Kush? You know
what? Sativa.
Yeah. And we say, but we do, we say there's no varieties because ours is distilled THC and distilled CBD. So it's pure. And what we do is we just buy what's called trim and shake from the grow houses. If ever you go to a grow house, you'll see what they do is they have these people that trim the plants to make the buds really pretty and to actually make the plants grow healthier and faster and better. And so all that, the stuff they trim off has THC and CBD in it. And you can buy that fairly cheap. Here, typically it'll be like $150 for a pound of that stuff. Mm. If you bought a pound of high quality buds, we already said about $200 an ounce, and there's 16 ounces in a pound. So 16 times 200 would be
3,200
dollars. So,
for 5 gallons of beer.
so for a pound of bucks, 3,200 versus $150.
Yeah.
All we do is we take all that shake and trim, which is, it's rich in CBD and THC. And so we throw it in the extractor, get the extract, activate it, encapsulate, and then emulsify. And we could do it at a fraction of the cost, mm-hmm. trim and shake versus using premium buds. Mm-hmm. So it makes it much easier, much more cost-effective.
That's really interesting. That I was wondering, after you went through the process of how to create that, I was thinking then that you probably didn't select for flavor. So that makes a lot of sense. But with the finished product, how does that addition of THC or CBD affect the final flavor of the beer, or does it?
Yeah, the only flavor that we get from CBD and THC, and in fact, any other cannabinoid, is bitterness. So with about 10 milligrams, you get the perceived bitterness of about 2 to 4 IBUs, but you can't measure it. We've tried measuring with standard IBU method and it doesn't work. So at this point in time, until the research catches up and somebody develops a method for measuring the bitterness of cannabinoids, we have to rely on sensory, and it's all perceived. So what you do is, if you're making a beer, for example, you compensate with a hop bill to decrease the bitterness just a bit to compensate for the bitterness coming in from the cannabinoids. But okay. You don't get any aroma, and that's the reason we chose distillate, is because for us it's all about the smell and taste of great craft beer versus cannabis. But in the future, we may make a beer with all the nice cannabis smells, the terpenes from cannabis. But for now, we're doing great tasting non-alcoholic craft beer with the effects of cannabis, not the smell or taste.
Okay. That's really interesting. I have one final question for you. Or sorry, Rachel, do you have a question?
No, it's good.
Oh, okay.
That's good.
I have one final question for you. I remember in like 2018, 2019, hearing people like Bart Watson from the Brewers Association, Lester Jones from the National Wholesalers Association, talking about how the predictions for, you know, the legalization of marijuana in more markets wasn't going to really affect the craft beer market, because they were saying, you know, the person who's using marijuana for, you know, for the THC, for the high, for those purposes, is not the same person who is drinking beer for the effects of alcohol. Like the, you know, that Venn diagram is very small. And a lot of it was really like, you don't need to worry about this. You know, these are two different customers. Or I remember Bart saying that the biggest increase in customer age group for legalized marijuana was like 55 and older. And so it seems like that has not exactly played out in the marketplace, where there is a market for the craft beer drinker who also wants something like THC, you know, in their beverage. So I guess my question to you is what are your thoughts on that? Because you were developing all of this, you know, when all of these economists were saying this is not something that we predict for the market.
Yeah, it's almost the same way. Back in 1995, when I launched Blue Moon, if I had listened to the market research people and, you know, people who knew the marketplace well, and I launched a Belgian style beer that was brewed with oats and wheat and barley malt and spiced with hops and coriander and orange peel, they would have said, no, don't do that. Are you crazy? Why would you do
that? A lager? That's not a light lager.
Yeah. But I did it simply because my wife and I had lived in Belgium for 4 years, and we were very familiar with what a beer culture was, and what because when I was there, they taught us about, you know, how to pair beer with food. They taught us about the brewing and the history of brewing in Belgium. And my professor was a consultant to quite a few breweries at that time. Belgium, gosh, when I was there, there were only about 103 or 104 breweries in Belgium. And he was a consultant at quite a few of them. So I'd go with him as he was consulting and learn all the secrets or whatever from the different breweries. And because I was exposed to all of that, I knew that at some point that culture was coming here to the States. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, here we are in 2022, and almost everybody lives within, I think it's 10 miles of a craft brewery. Mm-hmm. And you can go to a restaurant in almost any town and buy a craft beer, or go to a nice restaurant and potentially be able to order a dish made with beer, a good craft beer. So it's not crazy. Whereas when I came back from Belgium in 92, I remember I was trying to do beer dinners and everything. And chefs thought I was crazy. They said, you can't do that with beer. You do it with wine. And like, no, you can do it with beer. And I remember talking to them and giving them recipes from Belgium. And so they'd cook it up and they'd say, oh, wow, this really tastes good. This works. And, but it wasn't just me. I remember I was doing it here, and then I would travel the country. I would run into, like the guys from Full Sail, Rob, mm-hmm. Rob and his brother, Widmer Brewing Company, those guys, they were mm-hmm. doing it, but there were just a few doing beer dinners back then. And most people thought we were crazy, but I lived that culture. And so I knew it was coming here. So now that we've got all that clearly 2020 in our rearview mirror saying, oh yeah, it came, it's here. What I'm doing is looking into the future, saying, okay, with cannabis and NA beers, it's going to be a similar situation, because you look at NA beers here in the States, NA beers are less than 1% of the market. They're almost nothing. And in fact, I remember Bart Watson had a hard time even tracking sales because it was so small. Mm-hmm. he couldn't really do any modeling or anything, because it was just minuscule. But in Europe, you've got countries like Spain and Germany where NA beer is, you know, 8%, 12% of the sales of beer. So it can grow quite a bit potentially here in the States from less than 1%. Who knows? Even if it gets up to 5% of our beer market, that's huge.
It's huge. Yeah.
And then you look at cannabis, and cannabis is still federally illegal, but the more people learn about it, the more they say, you know what? And in fact, in the book I wrote, the introductory chapter talks about the reasons cannabis was made illegal here in the States. And it wasn't because it was this highly addictive drug, which everybody said it was. It was mainly through the actions of the one guy named Harry Anslinger, who was in charge of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. He was just dead set against cannabis, and he was also racist because he saw so many immigrants using it. He wanted a way to get rid of it. And he's the one who pretty much, with a couple of colleagues, started Reefer Madness, the whole thing that scared people into believing that cannabis needed to be illegal because it was such a threat to our society. But meanwhile, here we are again in 2022, and we've found that the cannabis plant actually has very useful properties. For example, Epidiolex is a medicine made from purified CBD, and it helps kids with severe forms of epilepsy. I mean, their parents are struggling trying to get this thing under control, and they find out that they can give the child Epidiolex, and it's not a cure, but it helps a lot. Mm-hmm. So, and here, all these years, our government has been telling us that the marijuana plant has no medical value, and it's highly addictive. So we've wasted years believing that, and so that's why I think we're going to see an explosion as soon as it's federally legal. We're going to see virtually every university in the United States start doing research, because universities get a huge amount of money from their intellectual property that their laboratories develop.
Right.
And if they can find the cannabinoids in the plants that cure cancer, or, there's over 100 cannabinoids in the plant, and people really don't know for sure conclusively what each of these things does, because it's been federally illegal to study the plant. And no university at this point wants to study cannabis and lose their federal funding.
Right. Yeah.
But once it's federally legal, you're going to see universities, you're going to see big pharma, everybody jump in to make money. Because at the end of the day, it's about money. I mean,
isn't it always?
Yeah. As sad as that sounds, it's all about money. And that's where it's going to be. And the companies that can identify these compounds and patent them, they're going to make a fortune. So, and that's one reason I published my book. Another reason is so that craft brewers everywhere, and even home brewers, can get into it, and maybe come up with a product made with cannabis that who knows, big pharma might be interested in their little product. Maybe it's a face cream, maybe it's a beer, maybe it's a beverage. I don't know, but that home brewer or that craft brewer may be able to sell it for, $20 or $50 million. I mean, you two could probably use $20 or $50 million.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess.
I got a lot of brewery debt.
So yeah, but I think in the future, it's going to be a whole different place. And that's why I'm really, really excited about the future, because to me, I don't look at market research. So back to your question, yeah, Bart and everybody, they said, this isn't going anywhere. It's not going to take a share out of craft brewing. Well, craft brewing sales have really slowed. And that's even after brewers jumped into the hard seltzer bandwagon. So craft brewers need something else to fuel that fire. And I think cannabis will probably be it, but if done the right way. And I see the cannabis market just being as big or even bigger than craft brewing, because already we're at $34 billion last year in sales. So it's a lot of money. And the whole beer industry is what, 120 billion. So cannabis at 34 billion, and that's only in like 18 states where it's recreationally legal,
right, and
36 or 39 states where it's medically legal. So once it's federally legal, it's just going to take off. And I think a lot of projections are it's going to be bigger than the beer market. So, so again, I go back to my book. I talk about how to market, how to sell, the legalities, and you know, you two should start your own cannabis company. And who knows, you guys buy your own private.
I'm already thinking about what I can do with my brewing system and my tank in North Carolina. Like, maybe I should make some batches of CBD water. You know, like, we sell CBD water in cans made by somebody else. Maybe I should make CBD water.
Yeah,
you already got me going. Trust me.
Yeah, because there's lots of like I said, the cannabinoids in the plant. We're only familiar, or most people are familiar, with THC and CBD, but there's others, lots of others. There's like THCV. Which is, they call that skinny cannabinoid. It's popular in California now because it helps you to feel satiated so that you're not hungry anymore. And so out in California, people are using that as a diet, a natural diet aid. And then CBG and CBN are really, really strong, like, sedatives. They really help put you to sleep. So if you're all stressed out and you can't sleep, you take those things together and it's like, wow, you sleep like a baby and wake up late the next day because you've had a really restful, thorough night's sleep. So there's just so many things you could do. And then CBD, that's useful for some people. But what we find is that it's really hit and miss, because some people can take a can of 25 milligrams and they say they're sleepy or tired. But a lot of people take that and they say, I didn't feel anything. And the reason for that is primarily because CBD doesn't act on the same receptors that THC and the other cannabinoids act on. CBD, it's a secondary reaction. And CBD almost always requires something else, another cannabinoid like CBN or CBG or THC, to help it do its job. So that's why... in the future, I think we're going to see a lot of these functional beverages pop up, and we're doing them here. I mean, our IPA, it has 10 milligrams of THC plus 10 of CBD. And the reason for that is because when some people take too much THC, they start to get kind of anxious and a little shaky, and almost like they've had a bunch of coffee. But when you give them the CBD in addition, it kind of mellows out that buzz so that they're buzzed, but not as anxious and shaky. It kind of have a nice, mellow, relaxing buzz. And so that's another thing, you know, like when you get into this world, you really have to do research before you release products out there, because we make our best guess. We're considered experts, but it's not like a world of brewing where you really can get a PhD in brewing, or you can be an expert in the science of it or some are artists in brewing, some are scientists. In cannabis right now, it's almost all art until the science comes in. So it's tough, but we'll just keep treading along here and make some big findings and just keep expanding our cannabis beers into other states. And just keep pushing that envelope, because it reminds me a lot of Blue Moon, because back then I remember trying to launch it in Kroger, Safeway, all those Publix, all the different store chains. And they would typically take us on for 3 months and then drop us because nobody bought it back then. Belgian beers were not popular. And I remember we just pushed and pushed and finally ended up building up the brand in the bar scene with the orange garnish glass and everything. So I created that orange garnish in 1997 for Blue Moon. I created that iconic glass in 1998 and really pushed it as hard as I could. And finally, in 2001 is when Blue Moon really started taking off and like a rising tide, it raised the tide so that a lot of brewers could jump in and make Belgian beers and really have no issues with it. But yeah, when you're first, it's tough. So with cannabis beer, it's tough out there, but we're educating people. And eventually we're going to reach the point, the tipping point, where you can't make enough product. And that's always it's a fun situation to be in when you're at that point where you can't fill all the orders because there's too many orders and you just keep cranking away. I've been in that situation and that's a great situation to be in.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And if our listeners want to learn more about you, more about Seria, where can they find more information?
Gosh, they can go to our Facebook page, our Twitter page, our homepage. Just search for Seria Brewing and you'll be able to find us, find what we're doing. Find if we're having any special events here in January, dry January, where we have an event with a
good one for you.
blood donation site, because January is National Blood Donation Month or whatever it is. And I've been a donor for a long time because I'm type O positive. So I can use my blood. So we're partnering and offering free six packs to blood donors.
Very nice.
You'll see that on our page for this month, but a lot of NA brewers are doing some fun things out there, and we'll just keep pushing that envelope and trying to expand the boundaries of what beer can be.
Right. Well, excellent. Thank you again so much. This was really, Rachel and I have been very excited about having this conversation, and we definitely appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise with us. So thank you again.
Yes. Now I'm going to go figure out how to make CBD, Pilot Brewing CBD water.
Right.
Coming up.
There you go.
Jeff is going to be like, oh my God.
This has been False Bottom Girls.
And we make the brewing world go round.